Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading today from CQ Magazine for February of 2012. CQ Magazine is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may reach that area 763-520-0512 or the email address handyham@courage.org. The website www.handyham.org. As those of you who listen on a regular basis know, I don't usually spend much time on the cover photograph of CQ, or for that matter, other magazines as well. But this time I'll spend a few moments giving credit to Tom Lutz, LUTZ, amateur call W0ZR of Minnetonka, Minnesota. Obviously, Tom, being from Minnesota, is a close nearby neighbor of the Courage Handy Ham system in Golden Valley, somewhere in Minnesota anyway. His commentary reads, Chasing DX is the primary passion of Tom Lutz of Minnetonka, Minnesota. Its current focus is on 160 meters, on which he'd confirmed 194 countries at press time. The 72-foot crank-up tower behind Tom, in the photo, is shunt-fed to serve as his 160-meter transmit antenna. He has a K9AY receiving loop to pick up incoming top-band signals. The tower also hosts several other HF antennas, including a high-gain TH-11DX for 10 through 20 meters, a two-element Cushcraft beam for 40, and a rotatable dipole for 80 meters. We'll talk more about Tom and his shack and other equipment later on in this issue. Let's go now to Ham Radio News. 5 years of code-free licensing. This month marks the fifth anniversary of the end of Morse code testing for all levels of FCC amateur radio licenses. The final code tests were administered on February 22, 2007, after being a part of the United States license exams since the inception of amateur radio licensing nearly a century ago. Over the decades, code test speeds rose and fell with changing times. Code testing from the entry-level technician class was eliminated in 1991. Since the end of code testing, the ranks of radio amateurs in the United States have increased by nearly 50,000, and many newer hams are learning CW even though it is no longer required. APRS weather balloon smashes distance record. An amateur radio weather balloon launched by a group of hams in California on December 11 flew across the United States and the Atlantic Ocean before landing in the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Algeria 3 days later. The balloon was carrying a ham radio APRS, APRS, that's Automatic Packet Reporting System transmitter, and was tracked by amateurs in North America and Europe as it made its record-smashing 6,236-mile journey. The flight nearly doubled the previous record of 3,361 miles. End of mission for AO-51. As the 50th anniversary of the December 12, 1961 launch of Oscar 1 approached in late November, controllers at AMSAT Oscar 51 announced that amateur satellites end of mission. AMSAT North America Vice President of Operations Drew Glessbrenner, KO4MA, said, It is with a heavy heart I report that AO-51 has ceased transmissions and is not responding to commands. AO-51 provided low Earth orbit satellite contacts for 7 years before its batteries finally failed. The AMSAT News Service reports that the AO-51 command team will regularly attempt to communicate with the satellite over the coming months and years in hopes that at least one of its batteries will come back to life. AMSAT seeks NASA funding for Fox 1. The amateur satellite plan to replace AO-51 is called Fox, that's F-O-X-1, and in mid-November, AMSAT submitted the project for consideration in NASA's CubeSat Launch Initiative, part of the space agency's educational programs. Educational components of the Fox 1 mission include incorporation in the ARRL's Teacher Institute seminars, according to the AMSAT News Service. Projects selected for the program will have their integration and launch costs paid by NASA, significantly easing the financial needs of the satellite builders. NASA pioneer W3PRB, Whiskey 3, Papa Romeo Bravo, now Silent Key. CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame member John Townsend, W3PRB, became a Silent Key in November. Townsend was one of NASA's early administrators responsible for the acquisition and construction of the Goddard Space Flight Center in Great Belt, Maryland. He was also a key negotiator of the first U.S.-Soviet space treaty. Townsend left NASA for several years to help establish the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, that's NOAA, N-O-A-A, and to work in private industry. After the explosion of the shuttle Challenger in 1986, he returned to NASA as Deputy Associate Administrator and led America's return to space. He also served as Goddard's director from 1987 until his retirement in 1990. Townsend was profiled in an interview in the June 2008 issue of CQ Magazine. You know, folks, we got a lot of bad weather in the United States, but obviously it happens elsewhere as well. Here's a report about the Radio Amateur Society of Thailand, RAST. The headquarters station was destroyed by flooding. Last fall's massive flooding in Thailand, the country's worst in 60 years, counted among its victims HS0AC, that's the station call, Hotel Sierra Zero, Alpha Charlie. Well-known Thai contester Champ Muon Agam Puan. Call is E21EIC/KY1A. Noted that photos of the devastation have been posted on the QSL website, www.qsl.net/RAST. Champ notes that anyone wishing to help with donations for rebuilding HS0AC may contact RAST International Liaison Officer Tony Waltham, W-A-L-T-H-A-M. His call, HS0ZDX. Tony's email is simply dx@thai.com. That's dx@thai.com. Seems like our friends in Great Britain are having some problems, too. RSGB reorganizes to try to save itself, beset by a scandal in which its former general manager allegedly stole thousands of pounds from the organization. The Radio Society of Great Britain, the acronym again, RSGB, has undertaken a major reorganization to try to stay afloat. At an extraordinary general meeting of the Society on November 19, RSGB members voted overwhelmingly to adopt a reform committee proposal to temporarily replace the elected board of directors with an interim board made up of 8 amateurs with significant business and financial expertise. According to the RSGB website, these directors will serve for 15 months and will take necessary actions to put the society back on a sound financial footing and make recommendations to the membership for future governance. One more interesting piece for the February 2012 CQ readout. Congress considers easing ITAR restrictions. International cooperation on amateur satellite missions has become nearly impossible since the United States government's enactment of its International Traffic in Arms Regulations, or ITAR. The rules limit exchanges of technology between countries, even friendly countries, if that technology could possibly have military applications. Violators face stiff fines and possible jail terms. According to the AMPSAT News Service, this rule has technically made AMPSAT NA a munitions supplier, even though its satellite technology has always been strictly for civilian use. Now, ANS reports that Congress is considering a bill, it's H.R. 3288, which is aimed at easing ITAR restrictions on commercial satellite development and which, if passed, may once again permit amateur satellite groups around the world to collaborate on multinational ham radio satellite projects. Ladies and gentlemen, I just picked up a bit more news before we leave the news piece here. It's dated February the 3rd, 2012. That's today's date as I record this. World Radio founder Armin Noble, amateur call N6WR, Silent Key. Armin Noble, N6WR founder and publisher of World Radio magazine for 37 years, died February 1 in Sacramento, California, after a short illness. Noble, publisher of Sacramento-based International Travel News magazine, was hospitalized about 2 months ago, according to editor David Tekel. World Radio was published monthly from July 1971 until the end of 2008, when Noble sold the magazine to Hicksville, New York-based CQ Communications Incorporated. With its February 2009 edition, it was renamed World Radio Online and became the first online-only major amateur radio publication. Noble had a long and distinguished career in communications. From 1953 to 1955, he served in the U.S. Army with the VHF radio relay unit. He went on to positions at commercial radio and TV stations around the United States, including KTWO-TV and KATI in Casper, Wyoming, KOOK-TV, Billings, Montana, KTVB, Boise, Idaho, KERO-TV, Bakersfield, California, WOOD-TV, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and KCRA Radio in Sacramento. During the Vietnam War, Noble was a reporter photographer for Time magazine and the Milwaukee Journal. He has served in the Time Life Bureau in Sacramento, California. I take these few moments to honor that gentleman because we have read many, many of his World Radio magazine recordings onto the Courage Handy Ham system and, of course, the Massachusetts Reading Network known as the Talking Information Center. So we pay our respects to Armin Noble, N6WR, Silent Key. Let's listen now to a CQ editorial by the editor of the magazine, Rich Mawson, amateur call W2VU. It's his column titled Zero Bias. No code plus 5 years, an assessment. 5 years ago this month, the FCC eliminated Morse code testing from all levels of amateur radio license exams. So, on this anniversary, let's take a moment to assess the impact of that decision on ham radio in general and on the use of CW continuous wave or Morse code on the air. To start with, the world is still here. Ham radio is still here. CW is still here. Despite the fears of many CW aficionados, the universe did not implode on February 23, 2007. Back in 2006, when the FCC was still trying to make up its mind, CQ's position was that a 5-word-per-minute CW exam for extra class ought to be retained. But we also believed that CW had enough appeal and offered enough benefits to stand on its own as an operating mode, regardless of whether a ham had to demonstrate proficiency in order to achieve a certain license class. We still believe that, and we believe history has shown us to be correct. We constantly hear stories of increased activity on the HFCW bands, especially among slower speed stations trying to build up their skills. On the other hand, Tom Lutz, W0ZR, who's on the cover this month and calls CW a longtime passion, feels code is becoming a lost art. Feelings, beliefs, and anecdotes aren't hard facts, though, so we try to get some of those to accompany our feelings and beliefs. We checked in with a manufacturer of keys and paddles, with the head of an international CW promotion group, with World Radio Online's Morse code columnist, and with the stats on our own contests, as well as FCC licensing statistics. Overall, they paint a very positive picture, plus or minus a few hiccups along the way. The manufacturer, whom we won't identify in print, said sales of its main line of paddles fell sharply in the 2 years after the CW test requirement was dropped, but then began a slow recovery that has continued over the past 3 years. Sales are not yet back to where they once were, but are heading in the right direction. It should also be noted that additional competition entered that segment of the marketplace in around the same time frame, so dropping the code requirement may not have been the only factor involved. The very fact that the field is growing rather than contracting is another positive sign. Another factor to consider is that a beginning CW operator is not likely to invest, not yet anyway, in paddles for an electronic keyer, so the sales figures shared with us perhaps paint a more accurate picture of those hams whose CW proficiency has increased to the point where a $100-plus investment for sending code becomes worthwhile. This interesting divide between beginners, learners, and committed CW operators also showed up in an assessment by Nancy Cott, W08C, president of the FIST CW Club, which, by the way, is celebrating its 25th anniversary this month. Congratulations to FIST from all of us at CQ. Nancy says she was worried that CW would disappear from the airwaves as a result of the FCC's dropping of the code test requirement. 5 years later, she says, "I am glad to see I was wrong. The use of Morse code is alive and well." However, she adds that, "I've given out literally thousands of free FISTS code course CDs, and many of our members are having well-populated code classes. But CW activity that's on the air from the newly licensed hams who joined FIST is oddly sparse. I don't know if it's cold feet or sunspot or whatever. We keep hearing the same old-timers over and over." Nancy speculates that although people have the desire to learn code, they often do not have the incentive to learn it well enough to be comfortable on the radio. On the other hand, Nancy paints a very positive picture looking toward the future. She notes that hams with technical curiosity, which led them to discover amateur radio, are finding uses for the code that involve new technologies. For example, they are incorporating it into videos and creating applications for smartphones, as well as having fun with it on the air. One way to qualify CW activity at a given point in time is to look at contest logs and compare activity then with similar activity now. Back in 2006, there were just over 4,500 logs submitted for that year's CW weekend of the CQ Worldwide DX contest. As of mid-December of 2011, with a couple of weeks still to go before the deadline, 6,500 CW logs had already been received from last September's competition. Remember, back in 2006, it was 4,500. This is a continuation of a steady climb in the past several years, with each year setting a new record, even as we've gone through the depths of an extended solar minimum. Yes, there are operating aids for contesters, such as the CW Skimmer, but the Skimmer alone can't account for 2,000 additional CW logs over the past 5 years. What can? Only one thing: increased interest and activity. It's highly unlikely that someone who doesn't operate CW 51 weekends out of the year will dive into the CQ Worldwide CW. Guess not. Bottom line, CW is hardly a dying art. In closing, it is clear that the future of CW is bright. Like ham radio itself, CW is alive and well, despite or perhaps because of, the elimination of the code test requirement. As the KC0CCR points out in his column, radio amateurs have not used CW because there was a test. CW has been used because it has been, and continues to be, a very useful mode of wireless communications. And as WC8 concludes, Morse code's timeless simplicity assures its place in ham radio, requirement or not. 73 W2VU, Rich Mawson, editor. Let's take a moment now for announcements. The following special event stations are scheduled for February. From the combined efforts of the Central Arizona DX Association, that includes Phoenix, Tucson, and Prescott, Arizona, the special event station K7UGA, Kilo 7 Uniform Golf Alpha, is going to be on the air to salute the 100th anniversary of Arizona's statehood. The dates are February 13 through 19, 1500 to 2359 Zulu, or Universal Time Constant. And ladies and gentlemen, if my memory serves me correctly, that special event called K7UGA was originally the call of Senator Barry Goldwater, a famous individual in American politics, in the United States Senate, and a really fine statesman for the American cause throughout the world. Mr. Goldwater passed away several years ago. Going down south, Orlando, Florida, the Orlando Amateur Radio Club will hold the 66th Annual Orlando Hamcation Amateur Radio and Computer Show next weekend, February 10 through 12 at the Central Florida Fairgrounds. In Salem, Oregon, the Salem Repeater Association is having their 32nd Annual Salem Hamfest February 18th at the Polk County Fairgrounds. Yuma, Arizona, the ARRL 2012 Southwest Division Convention and the 8th Annual Yuma Convention and Emergency Preparedness Show will be held on February 17 and 18 at the Yuma County Fairgrounds. New Providence, New Jersey. The New Providence Amateur Radio Club will be holding its annual auction on February 24 at the New Providence Municipal Center. And Burlington, Vermont, South Burlington, the radio amateurs of Northern Vermont will sponsor Ham-Con, HamCon, on February 25 at the Holiday Inn Convention Center. That's at Exit 14 on Interstate 89. Now, folks, getting to the articles for the February 2012 issue of CQ Magazine, we have a market survey. It's done once a year. The author last year and again this year is Gordon West, amateur called WB6NOA. Gordon is a renowned individual in amateur radio training and teaching for prospective hams. This article, I've timed it in my mind, will run somewhere around 30 minutes. That is much too long for our recording purposes for the coverage anti-ham system and other services. So I'll give you the introduction to it and just a little bit of fill in between, quite a few pages. It begins on page 13 of CQ for February 2012, should you like to get a friend of yours in the amateur community or someone who can read you this material. And why I say that, if you're new into amateur radio or are considering buying any kind of new, small, handheld gear, this is the opportunity to find out about just about every single new product on the market. It's one reason why it's such a large article. It comes off with this introduction. This should be a great year for the portable VHF-UHF market. Those are the little handy talkies. Prices remain steady with Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, and Alanco, the big HD4. Chinese single-band and double-band handhelds may appeal to the most frugal of HD buyers, coming in as low as $69 U.S. for a two-band HD, that's handy talkie, and $49 for a single-bander. If your current HD runs on older nickel-cadmium, Nightclad batteries. Finding replacement ICATs is getting tough. Sure, you can upgrade to nickel metal hydrides, that's NIMH, but this pack may not be compatible with your old NICD charging system. Many of the new HDs that we will review in this article now incorporate lithium ion, L-I-I-O-N, sealed packs, along with the rapid charger cup. So this new gear may play for twice as long as your current trusty HD on NICDs. Our ham radio ranks have grown over 700,000, with a spike in new hams coming on board from Community Emergency Response Teams, CRT, programs. Plenty of CRT members studied and passed the ham tests as part of their continuing CERT upgrade education. Lots of these volunteer emergency responders are fascinated and enthusiastic about their new ham radio privileges, but have limited funds for this new hobby. CERT operators can get on the air for under $100. We'll be dividing our HD market survey into the following categories: single-band HDs, two-band and dual-band HDs. There is a difference. And tri-band, quad-band, and handheld D-Star transceivers. Working alphabetically through each group, we will cover them all. And before we launch into that, here's a tip. If you are a member of Coast Guard Auxiliary, MARS, which is Military Auxiliary Radio System, or Civil Air Patrol, work with your local radio dealer to determine which handheld may do out-of-ham band double duty legally. Regular ham radio handhelds may no longer be used on federal government frequencies because of tighter specifications and more or less 2.5 kilohertz band-wide limitations. Check with your military communications officer to see which handhelds can be used for both ham and federal auxiliary operation. Now, for the listeners, I stated at the beginning of this market survey, it begins on page 13. And concludes on page 25 of February 2012 CQ. I'll give you the closing comments. If you need more information and you really want to get into what these are, and there are a lot of illustrations about every single one of these pieces of equipment, it's a great little mini encyclopedia in this kind of equipment. If you are new to ham radio, find a local club and see which radios its members are supporting. Does the club do cloning and programming before its meetings? Local amateur clubs are often associated around a specific repeater, so join in, and most importantly, support both the club and the repeater with a modest membership contribution. Those contributions, as a side, folks, are usually $10-$15. It's not a big deal, but it certainly is important to the club, if they have several hundred members, to continue to improve the facilities, the equipment, and the overall atmosphere of that meeting place. This will help make the new handheld an important investment in case of an emergency. Use that handheld regularly. Can you work it in the dark? When an emergency hits, you'll need to find that handheld and come up quickly and automatically on your local repeater or simplex frequency. Support your local net with regular weekly check-ins. This makes you a regular, someone who's to be counted on when an emergency really exists. And one last tip, when operating a handheld in a vehicle, use an external magnetic antenna and pick up 12 volts to conserve the HD battery. Next, switch to low or medium power, never high power. High power causes the HD to get hot, and if you are mobile, use an external microphone. You could actually toast your favorite seat cover. I don't want to do that. And finally, get your handheld from a reputable dealer who will back up the sale with service. The little HDs don't normally break, but if you need one fixed or replaced, you want that dealer to be there for you and your handheld. And certainly, again, I thank Gordon West for a great job. What a effort this must have been putting it together for the last few weeks, perhaps few months. Gordon West, WB6 NOA. Our next feature article, Teslagram, Teslagram, a multinational special event for a nearly forgotten laboratory. The author here is Richard Mawson, W2VU. He happens to be the editor of the magazine as well. Thomas Edison's laboratory in New Jersey is a national historic park. The tower for Edwin H. Armstrong's first FM radio transmitter, also in New Jersey, is protected as part of Palisades Interstate Park. Guglielmo Marconi has a national historic park in Canada and a state historic site in California. Nikola Tesla's laboratory in Shoreham, New York, is a vacant building on a fenced-off property. Dorman-Sens owner, Afka Givert, stopped manufacturing activities there in 1987. But there is an effort underway to turn the building into a science museum, and that's where ham radio is playing a role. Nikola Tesla is perhaps the least appreciated of the technological pioneers who are responsible for the way of life enjoyed by most of the world today. From his development of alternating current, AC, for generating and distributing electrical power, to his many contributions to early radio. We'll leave the question of who invented radio for another forum another time. Born in what is now Serbia, in 1856, Tesla came to the United States in 1884 and did most of his work here. His biggest and most grandiose laboratory was built on a 200-acre estate in eastern Long Island, which he called Warden Cliff. It was here that he planned a massive radio transmitting facility through which he envisioned transmitting communications and electric power through the air to the rest of the world. It was that last part of the equation that prompted Tesla's main financial sponsor, George Westinghouse, to withdraw his support, famously asking, "Where will we put the meter?" Today, an organization known as the Tesla Science Center at Warden Cliff is spearheading efforts to purchase and restore the now abandoned laboratory and make it home to a new science center. One of its activities has been the sponsorship of periodic Tesla conferences, the most recent of which was held this past November 5. One component of this conference was Tesla-Graham, G-R-A-M, a multi-station special event on the ham bands. The story of Tesla-Graham is one of typical ham radio cooperation and assistance, and grew from a simple idea by a visiting ham to help publicize the efforts to build a science center at Warden Cliff. Hamilton Carter, amateur call KD0FNR, is a graduate student at New Mexico State University doing research at Brookhaven National Laboratory in eastern Long Island. A longtime Tesla fan, Carter was delighted to discover Warden Cliff just a few miles from where he is living with his wife and young daughter. When he heard about the Tesla conference, Carter came up with the idea of trying to run a special event station from the lab site. Only problem was that he'd never done anything like that before and didn't know where to start. That problem was solved with a chance CW contact with Dick Pav, P-A-V, call K2RFP, who lived nearby. Dick told Hamilton that November 5th was also the date that his radio club, the Radio Central Amateur Radio Club, was planning a special event station to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the opening of Marconi's, later RCA's, transmitting station at Rocky Point, New York, also on Long Island. Dick invited Hamilton to the next club meeting, where he got not only help in organizing the special event station, but offers of equipment for use as well. Next, Hamilton went to the leadership of the Science Center group with the proposal. They not only supported the idea, but proposed making it even bigger, suggesting that he try to set up several special event stations at various significant sites in Tesla's life and career. The Science Center folks suggested three locations: Serbia, where Tesla was born; Colorado Springs, Colorado, where he'd built a prototype of his lab at Wardenclyffe and New York City, where the inventor lived and worked for many years. Carter also had some engineering contacts in Serbia. He asked them for help, and one promptly put him in touch with Vladimir Jelenković, the director of the Tesla Museum in Belgrade. Jelenković reached out to the academic radio club Mihajlo Pupin, YU1EXY, and other Belgrade hams, who arranged to put YU1TESLA on the air from the museum on November 5. For New York City, Carter recalled reading an article by Diana Inc., KC2UHB, about operating a portable satellite station from Central Park. Even though he'd never met Diana, he sent her an email, and she responded enthusiastically. But neither Diana nor her friends from the NYC Resistor Maker Group had access to any Tesla-related locations in Manhattan. The Tesla Science Center board came to the rescue here, putting Hamilton in touch with Joe Kinney, the building engineer for the New Yorker Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, where Tesla had lived from 1933 until his death in 1943. It turns out that Joe is a former ham as well as a Tesla fan and was also enthusiastic about the idea. He arranged for Diana and friends, including this author, to operate from the balcony of a decommissioned room on the hotel's 38th floor. He also gave them a tour of Tesla's old room and Tesla-era electrical equipment that is still in the hotel basement. The balcony has an unobstructed view of the West, but particularly important since the satellite station was slated to be the highlight of the operation there. And the building itself served as a relatively effective shield for all the RF generated all around it. The New Yorker is only a few blocks west of the Empire State Building, which houses all of New York City's television transmitters, as well as many FM broadcasts and other radio transmitters. Diana and the NYC Resistor crew arranged for a special event call sign N3Y, November 3 Yankee, for the operation. Hamilton requested and received W3T, Whiskey 3 Tango, for his operation at the Tesla lab in Wardenclyffe. Next, Carter reached out to some hams in Colorado Springs. They also responded with a yes, but too late to arrange for a special event call. 8 Colorado hams each operated under their own call signs. In addition, QSL cards were designed by Jeff Merry, K1NSS, who draws the ham radio comic Dash Dunes, and was also an operator of W3T. It turned out that 2 other special event stations honoring major events in radio history were also planned for the same day. The RCA station 90th anniversary mentioned above and the 76th anniversary of the first FM transmission in Yonkers, New York by experimental station W2XAG. The Yonkers Amateur Radio and Computer Kids Club today holds that call and was planning, along with the Yonkers Police Athletic League Amateur Radio Club, to activate it on November 5 as well. The Yonkers folks joined forces with Carter and became part of the broader Tesla operation. This author had the opportunity to join the N3Y operation at the New Yorker, where we put 2 HF stations, a satellite station, and an APRS beacon on the air. The station made over 60 contacts on HF as well as 6 by satellite. Satellite was AO51. We had about a dozen operators there, a mix of new and experienced hams and a mix of ages as well, with the majority being younger, 30-something, hams. At Wardenclyffe, the W3T folks made over 100 QSOs on 30 and 15 meters, clustered in the United States, Canada, and Europe. As of this writing, summaries had not yet been received from YU0TSLA or the Colorado Springs station. Updated information should be available online at KD0FNR's website. Since the main purpose of this event, other than an excuse to play radio from interesting locations for a day, was to raise awareness and, indirectly, funds for the possible acquisition and restoration of Warden Cliff to use as a science center. I got in touch with Tesla Science Center Board President Jan Alcorn and asked her how much money they were trying to raise. Quoting here, "The cost of purchasing the property is about $1.2 million, she replied. "We anticipate that the whole project, including gutting and restoring the building and grounds, will take us into the $10-plus million range." Alcorn said the primary focus now is on acquiring the property, since large-scale fundraising from charitable foundations, etc., will be more effective once the group has ownership. "We believe that once we have acquired the site, we will be eligible for a variety of grants from both the government and from private sources," she said, adding that a large grant has been promised by New York State, but only after the property has been purchased. "Right now," Alcorn concluded, "we are trying to get support via individuals. Many contributions of small amounts will add up if we get enough of them. If you would like to support this effort, U.S. tax-deductible donations may be made via PayPal by going to the following internet location, http://www.teslascienceencenter.org/. Now spoken out, that's www, then one long word, teslasciencecenter.org. Or you can send checks made out to and sent to Tesla Science Center at Warden Cliff, one word, WardenCliffe, P.O. Box 552, Shoreham, New York, Shoreham, Shoreham, New York, NY, zip code 11786. And now just a few observations and conclusions. If you listen to chit-chat on repeaters or on 75 meters, read the postings on ham websites, or read a lot of my mail, you would be convinced that there are no more young hams, and that those who have managed to sneak in unnoticed really don't know anything and don't want to know anything. I wish all of those people making these comments had had the opportunity to join me out on the balcony of the New Yorker on November 5. My overwhelming impression was that this reminded me tremendously of events and activities I'd gone to 20 years ago when I was a 30-something ham. Both younger and older hams, new and more experienced hams, learning from each other, trying new things, doing ham radio, having fun. It was nice that we managed to make some contacts and bring other hams into the fun of the event with us. But even if we hadn't, the worldwide ham camaraderie that makes this hobby so special was there in full force. Congratulations to KD0FNR for making his first effort as a special event station, a multi-station, multinational success. I'm proud to have been part of it. That concludes Richard Mawson's commentary on the article titled "A Multinational Special Event for the Nearly Forgotten Laboratory." You know, as I finish this article, folks, there's an interesting little sidebar here that says, "Back in stock, Heathkit." Remember that name from way back when a lot of you were kids? I do, and I'm over 80 years of age. It's a guide to amateur radio products by Chuck Penson, amateur call WA7ZZE. Back by popular demand, you can pick up this 328-page edition, and you won't be able to put it down. A must-have for collectors and ham history buffs, and a terrific trip down memory lane for many hams. If you're interested in the book, you can order it from CQ Communications Incorporated, the publishers of this Magazine, CQ, and of also World Radio. They're located at 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801, or you can call them at area 516-681-2922. Ask about the Heath Kit, the Guide to Amateur Radio Products by Chuck Benson, and they'll give you all the details as to how you can acquire it. It's time now for a few announcements. The 2012 CQ Worldwide WPX Contest. Two phases. Single sideband, March 24 through 25, starts at 0 Greenwich Mean Time on Saturday. And the CW is in May 26th through 27. It ends 23:59 Greenwich Mean Time Sunday. The objective is for amateurs worldwide to contact as many amateurs and prefixes as possible during the contest period. The period of operation, 48 hours. Single operator stations may operate 36 of the 48 hours. Off times must be minimum of 60 minutes, during which no QSO is logged. Multi-operator stations may operate the full 48 hours. Now, as regards to the bands that are going to be active, only the 1.8, 3.5, 7, 14, 21, and 28 megahertz bands may be used. Observance of established band plans is strongly encouraged. Those of you who are listening to this and may have been involved in the worldwide WPX contest know that it's very active. There are various entry categories that must be adhered to so as to make it fair and square for all concerned. It's important to note that only logs submitted in electronic format are eligible for awards. A single-band log will be eligible for a single-band award only. To be eligible for an award, a single-operator station must show a minimum of 4 hours of operation. Multi-operator stations must operate a minimum of 12 hours. Of course, there'll be the numerous kinds of plaques and certificates for both individuals and club competition for the 2012 CQ Worldwide WPX Contest. Again, for single sideband, that's voice, March 24 through 25, and for Morse code CW, May 26 and 27. We have a very interesting public service article by Richard Fisher, KI6SN. It's titled, From the Great North, a great story about a great story. It's introduced by a commentary by Jill Burke, AlaskaDispatch.com. This is a quotation. Ham operators are an interesting group. Though unpaid, they're deeply committed to public service. Although they willingly take to the airwaves, some prefer to be heard, not seen, a characteristic WL7MR likens to bull elk in hunting season. Close quote. Not too long ago, there was a story on AlaskaDispatch.com about radio amateurs' emergency communication support when a particularly nasty, near-perfect bearing sea storm slammed into the state's coastline in late 2011. It recounts the misery residents endured and the tenacity, ingenuity, and expertise hams used to help the region's citizens get through it. In early November 2011, this weather system developed into one of those brutal events that put amateurs on high alert and many people in Alaska in mind of amateur radio's legacy of public service in the state, notably dating to the 1964 earthquake almost a half century ago. There are photographs on this page about that. In her online magazine piece, Dispatch reporter Jill Burke not only accounted for radio amateurs' vital support in the aftermath of the November 2011 storm, but added historical perspective to our hobby's public service in the state. We cite her piece not because it is particularly complimentary to amateur radio, but because it is so thorough and filled with sharp insight. It is a legend in public service reporting for journalists and wannabes. In describing this jet stream fed wintry sea spun tempest that sideswiped Alaska's western coast, Burke observed what public service oriented hams wish everyone knew, because they live it. When other communications failed, ham radio operators came to the rescue. Throughout the storm, they were the eyes for scientists in Fairbanks and Anchorage, who otherwise would have been blind to weather conditions they could predict but not see. Burke, a former reporter for local KTUU-TV, who transitioned to online reporting with AlaskaDispatch.com, sought out Carvin Scott, National Weather Service forecaster in Anchorage, for a non-AMS perspective on amateur radio's MCOM contribution. They, that is the amateurs, were providing critical observations. We don't have a lot of meteorological observations in the West. We don't have the instruments out there. Data such as wind direction and velocity, sea level and wave height, air temperature, and snowy or rainy observations were vital, Scott said. Messages from small villages that were deceptively simple, Burke wrote, provided the NWS with critical pieces to the puzzle. Whatever you do, don't cut it off, because this stuff is really helping us, Scott told the radio amateurs. Those seemingly unimportant pieces of information help us characterize where the front is, Scott told Burke. Without that information, it would impact our ability to execute our mission, which is the protection of life and property and enhancement of national commerce. The Amateur Radio Emergency Service, that's ARES, A-R-E-S, in Alaska, leaned on the services of Martin Rood, amateur call WL7MR, to be an information clearinghouse from his home station in Nome. Working from Tuesday night as the storm descended until Thursday morning, Rood manned his home base station, Burke wrote. He draped sleeping bags over his windows to protect himself and his equipment in case a wind gust shattered the glass. Outside, a 160-meter loop stood ready atop four telephone poles the city of Nome gave to him for free, knowing he could put people in contact when other methods failed. In a story, Burke observed, ham operators are an interesting group. Though unpaid, they're deeply committed to public service. Although they willingly take to the airwaves, some prefer to be heard, not seen, a characteristic Rood likened to bull elk in hunting season. That may explain Rood's preference to conduct an interview by email instead of over the phone. Many small communities relied on the internet or phone connections to report to Rood, who then put observations into an email format that was transmitted via ham radio to processing centers, sometimes with pictures attached. Burke cited amateur radio's advantage of self-reliance. They don't need AC power nor an internet or satellite connection. Generators and car batteries can power the equipment, making them independent of any community's power or communication grid. And with receiving stations spread throughout the world, it's relatively easy to find a way to get the message through. Describing Rood's messages circuitous route, the dispatch story said his dispatches were first picked up in Petaluma, California, rather than monitoring stations in Fairbanks or Anchorage, before being sent to their intended recipients in Alaska. This network allowed the village of Sishmeref to get word out nearly 11 o'clock one night that none of its residents had been injured. Phones still worked. There was no known damage. The gym was open, businesses were closed, and help wasn't needed. Then the critical weather information. Calm winds, water still rising, lots of water in the lagoon slowly getting into homes. Rood, WL7MR, was able to distribute a picture sent from the village to Kayuk showing ice beginning to build, as well as this message, quoting, blizzard conditions set in, 10 p.m., winds 15 from the southeast, gusts up to 25. Tide has not come in yet. Tide receded about 3.5 feet from the highest tide. No property damages as of last update or personal injury. Still haven't heard if the school or businesses will close tomorrow. Business are open normal hours this evening. So far, so good. For nearly 48 hours, Rood kept at it, funneling messages to and fro, Burke said. By early Thursday morning, he and the rest of the ham stood down. In adding historical perspective, Burke used the 1964 Alaska earthquake as a touchstone. When state military communication grids were interrupted, the amateur operator stepped in to help Alaskans get messages for family and loved ones outside. During the 2011 storm, Eris showed it's a good complement to the state's emergency system, she said. More than a backup, it demonstrated it can fill information gaps, though it will never replace the communication used by those in command. Ham operators always defer to official responders during any crisis. Alaska State, local communities, and military authorities have taken note and begun to include amateur radio in the way they respond to disasters, Jim Larson, AL7FS, told Burke. We actually hope we never get used, but we want to help our community, so if they need us, we want to be as prepared as we can, he said. We are a force multiplier for the management. In conclusion, Burke observed that radio amateurs don't seem to want pats on the back. Mostly, they seem to only want to help. Ham operators do this all the time, Root said via email to Burke. The volunteers in the villages are the real heroes who are willing to help out their communities. The author Richard Fisher continues with a commentary regarding Delaware's operations. Delaware ops step up for Hurricane Irene. Here on the East Coast, many of us weathered that Irene storm with a lot of crossed fingers and toes, I gotta tell you. In a hurricane with as massive a footprint as 2011's Irene, it should not be surprising that CQ's public service columnist is still catching up with reports from MCOM groups who answered the call. This month, the Sussex County, Delaware, ARIS, front and center, recounting its activities in support of served agencies over the weekend of August 27-28, bringing vital communications to two area hospitals and two local shelters. Herb Quick, call KF3BT, reports that during a 30-hour period, 33 amateur radio operators volunteered a total of 357.5 person hours in service to ARIS assignments. A total of 60 hams participated in the hurricane net. Quick said more than 600 people, many of them pets, were evacuated from flood zones to shelters during the hurricane. Tactical communications were coordinated to a highly efficient net, he said, with control operators serving three-hour shifts. Following requests for support received in the days prior to Hurricane Irene's landfall, ARIS leadership drafted an operations plan based on normal storm procedures. Communications teams were assigned to Beebe Medical Center, that's in Lewis, Delaware, Nanticoke Memorial Hospital in Seaford, Beacon Middle School Shelter in Lewis, and Sussex Technical High School Shelter in Georgetown. Quick said, adding, early planning and coordination prior to the weather event was crucial to the success of the ARIS operation. He said VHF and UHF and Windlink links were quickly established at the hospitals and all amateurs operated to make sure that radio systems were established and operated as necessary to support the service agencies. In addition to high winds associated with Irene, a tornado touched down in Lewis, a major Sussex County coastal town, Quick said. Echolink was activated in receive mode to allow local amateurs who were away from their Sussex County homes an opportunity to keep abreast of the local conditions. He said Sussex County ARIS and other local radio amateurs did an excellent job supporting their communities in southern Delaware. Many lessons were learned and incorporated into ARIS after action to improve future operations and service. The author Richard Fisher continues with a commentary about the wonderful work being done by MCOM in the state of Michigan during those times of crisis. That's it for this month, he states. Next time, we will continue with more on how hams serve the public in many ways, including when all else fails. Sign 73, Richard, KI6, SN. Let's take a quick peek at DX. It's authored by Carl Smith, call N4AA, November 4, Alpha Alpha. DX, for those of you not familiar with the ham speak, is distant contacting of stations elsewhere in the world other than the 48 contiguous United States. Just a short bit of information here before we close. It really seems strange that I'm writing something for the second month of next year. That's, of course, this year, February this year, as it is early December right now. Such is life in the publishing world. All of this material must flow through a myriad of people and processes before being finalized in the format that you will see a couple of months from now, be it the print format or the digital version of CQ Magazine. That's not at all like our beloved ham radio, where we turn on the radio and within minutes we can be talking to people all over the world. Isn't ham radio great? It sure is, and we love it. The ARRL's Logbook of the World is a great service, in my opinion. Is it absolutely free? No. But is anything totally trouble-free? I doubt it. A serious backlog developed after the CQ Worldwide DX Single Sideband Contest the end of October. Hundreds of logs were sent to LOTW, Logbook of the World, and it hiccuped. Days after someone sent in a log, it was finally accepted. However, by that time, people got nervous and started sending their logs again, and again, and yet again. I was told there was one log that was sent over 20 times. Now, really, was that necessary? Of course not. And it just points out the problem. A lot of folks have become so accustomed to having everything happen now that when something does not happen now, they go berserk. Please, folks, have patience. The year 2011 ended with some really good propagation and some really good de-expedition operating by some really great folks. Look at 9N7MD from Nepal, for example. The latest information on the website shows that in the 10 days of operation, the team logged 28,301 QSOs with 11,838 unique call signs in 158 countries and all 40 of the CQ zones. Considering where Nepal is, it is no surprise that the bulk of the QSOs were with Europe and Asia. Still, they show 20% or 5,600 with the Americas. Another plus is a 17% or nearly 4,900 digital QSOs. All in all, I would consider this de-expedition quite successful. T2T, Tango 2 Tango from Tuvalu, is another operation I would consider to have been quite successful. In the DX Magazine's Most Wanted Survey in the year 2010, Worldwide T21 was ranked at number 75, and for 2011, it had moved up to number 62. That survey was before the T2T operation. The team was on the island from November 10 to December 4. It consisted of five amateurs with calls from different areas of the world, and he had to make do with less than the planned array of equipment and antennas due to transportation snafus beyond their control. It seems there was a water shortage on Tuvalu, and transportation was being devoted to getting water to the island. The irony of all that was, on the day the team arrived, it started to rain and continued for 3 days, relieving the shortage of water. On top of that, several of the team members came down with a stomach bug for a time, making the manning of radios more difficult. In the end, they managed 42,060 QSOs with 16,215 unique call signs. The majority of the contacts were on CW. That's Morse code again, folks, 69%. But they did put forth a good effort on digital with 3,587 Qs. Somewhat surprising to me was the breakdown by area. North America made up 47%, while Europe and Asia shared almost the same number with 23-25% respectively. With the improved propagation, they spent a lot of time on 10, 12, and 15 meters, with 15 being their top QSO band, 20 running a close second, and 10 just behind those two bands. What a difference a few years makes. In the recent past, we would not have seen those kinds of numbers on the higher frequency bands, and wasn't it great to hear those signals? You bet it was. The author Carl Smith goes on to comment about other area activities and other worldwide de-expeditions that are rather fascinating, but to the newbie, who may be one of you listening, let's just go to a final commentary about DXers sharing. The title of this serves only as a reminder, because we DXers already share in many ways. But at times, we need that extra little kick instead of wondering what is in that box in the basement. We simply forget that many around the world and here at home need equipment to give us that signal to work. So let's get hopping and not only help others, but clean out our own areas as well. I needed to be reminded of this. Recently, a good friend who was a de-expedition leader and a super de-exer mentioned he was buying a rig for an elderly friend because the friend truly needed it to stay on the air. Wow, that was nice. And as my grandson would say, awesome. This DXO already helps in many ways by being a good leader. But this was going way beyond. Thanks, friend. Helping with antenna parties, putting coax connections on for others at club meetings, leading a class explaining to others the difference among the digital modes. Yes, I knew this one. Or helping out as a VE volunteer examiner are things some of us already do, but to donate equipment to someone who might otherwise be off the air is something many of us could do. I'd like to see DX clubs pass the hat and buy a roll of coax, an antenna, a digital interface, a subscription to a magazine, or even a rig for those who need it. Equipment doesn't need to be the K3, FD5000, or any of those other high-priced rigs. But many of us have older rigs that are just gathering dust and are not being used at all. Be sure to check them out first, but please consider it on an individual basis, as a club or with the monthly lunch bunch. Books are also a good place to start. I recently saw the newest version of the ARRL antenna book, it's version 22. It takes wheels to move it, but it's awesome. I love antenna books. I've read them since my Elmer said I should, but this book is something else. Think about a book for a DX friend. Uncle DX has some really good ideas, and this is one of them. There are any number of books available on various topics available from the American Radio Relay League, ARRL, from CQ and or others. These are not necessarily cheap, but just think of the benefit one or two might be to someone who might never have the opportunity to even see one. Till the next time, enjoy the chase and do have fun. 73 Carl and 4AA. We'll conclude today's activities on the recording for CQ Magazine for February 2012 with a commentary about certain awards by Ted Milanowski, amateur call K1BV. This one has a little bit of significance. He's talking about the Commonwealth Jubilee Award. This time we start out with a short-term award for 2012 from England. We then move on to awards from Namibia, Brazil, and Corsica. We'll deal with the one from England today. England's Commonwealth of Nations Jubilee Award 2012. Radio amateurs across the world are invited to work stations in the Commonwealth of Nations during the calendar year 2012. This award celebrates the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Elizabeth II, and especially her position as head of the Commonwealth of Nations. Since the Jubilee takes place in 2012, the award will run for 12 months, starting on January 1, 2012, and ending on December 31 of this year, 2012. There are 139 qualifying Commonwealth call areas. A certificate will be awarded to every licensed radio amateur who makes contact with stations located in 60 and 100 different Commonwealth call areas during 2012. Any mode of transmission may be used. Contact made via the Internet do not count. A simple spreadsheet can be downloaded from the website listed below to facilitate record keeping. A league table will be on the same website showing the number of call areas contacted by participating stations. No QSL or other verification is required. Certificates will be available for download and printing by stations who claim the contacts required. Please note that CWQSOs made by non-Commonwealth stations during the Commonwealth contest on March 10 through 12, 2012 should not be counted. If you wish to take the opportunity to apply for the main Commonwealth Century Club Awards, then you should follow the procedure on the web page. Here are the requirements. 1. Keep track of Commonwealth call areas you have worked using the score sheet. Download the score sheet from the link below. Enter the call sign of the station worked and the date contact was made. Then every week, email your scores to the league table at G3PJT, that's Golf 3 Papa Julia Tango. Just the call sign, G3PJT, at BInternet, that's one word, BTINTERNET.com. 2, claiming your certificate. When you have reached the goal of 60 or 100 different Commonwealth stations needed, then just email your score sheet to G3PJT. Your certificate will be emailed to you for printing on your printer. There is no cost for the award. The spreadsheet that's being mentioned here is available at www.rsgb-spectrumforum, one word, spectrumforum.org.uk/ccc.htm. Click on the score sheet link, which will open an Excel spreadsheet. Of course, some of you don't have internet connections, so I apologize if I tend to bore you folks on some things, but many of you do. The world is coming to that, even for people with, even with folks who are print or sight impaired. So there you have this reading for February 2012 of CQ Magazine here on the Courage Handy Ham System. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications, Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, all lowercase, handyham@courage.org. We always spell our Handy Ham, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M is one word, handyham@courage, C-O-U-R-A-G-E.org. We have a great website. It's maintained by professionals every single day. It's interesting to listen to and just to look at sometimes. It's http://www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm recording this at my home in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're right on the coastline of Massachusetts down below Boston, about 50 miles. We sort of consider ourselves the gateway to good old Cape Cod. Remember that Patti Page song? 73s. Look forward to a nice spring. It's not too far away, folks. Bye-bye.